Hello, everyone. Welcome back to LinkedIn Live. It's our second show. Hopefully, you can all hear us. First and foremost, I'm joined by my guest here, Jen Crenshaw. Jen, we met 2 hours ago, right?
That's about right. Yeah.
two hours ago, and here we are. So we had a great conversation, guys. And I said to Jen, you know what, Jen? How about we just get you online right now, live with everyone? So it's pretty fantastic. So welcome to the show, guys. If you're new to HR Leaders Podcast, on the show, we interview today's most successful and innovative HR practitioners 5 days a week. And it's now going to be here live with you all on LinkedIn. Welcome to the show, Jen. Before we jump in, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself personally and your journey to where we are today.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a human resources professional. I've been in HR for over 20 years. It's a little crazy that I can say that. But currently on educational sabbatical. I'm a student at Georgia State University working on my doctorate in business administration and have chosen to study career transition and very specifically identity. And how our identity is affected by our career transition process, and decided to really focus in on the transition that military veterans go through. So I'll be talking with a host of Army veterans about their own career transition into the civilian world, and then publishing that as my dissertation. So really excited. I'm in the throes of it right now. I'm going through all the check boxes that you go through to get approval to do research. And it's just a lot of fun. Really, really supportive team at Georgia State University. Couldn't say enough about that program. It's been a lot of fun and really enjoyed my conversation with you this morning on this topic. Yeah. So look forward to continuing.
Well, thank you for being brave enough to say yes. I was speaking to you and I was like, you know what? I wish I was live on LinkedIn right now, Jen, sharing this with everyone. So I was like, let's do it. And you were crazy enough to say yes. And here we are. And that's the magic of what we do, right? We jump on a call. You're halfway across the world. 2 hours later, we're live here on LinkedIn with everyone. So how amazing is that?
It's pretty cool.
So tell us, why did you decide to go on an educational sabbatical? You've worked in incredible organizations, you know, likes of Burger King and you know, huge multinationals. What made you think, you know what, I want to step away for a second on an educational sabbatical before I come back and return?
Yeah, so this program is an accelerated program, and so it's 3 years, and at first I wasn't going to take time. I was able to, make it work with a full-time work schedule. And most of my classmates are still working full-time. And I was, too, for the first 18 months of the program. And then just really decided, you know, through a course of several things that it made a lot of sense for me to just kind of, step back and spend some thought time. I'll tell you that, in a very busy 20-year career in HR, sometimes I love to produce. I love to do and see the fruits of my labor. And so I don't always take the time that I should to reflect, to kind of stop pushing myself to produce. And really just sit back and have thought time and have reflection time. So I will just say that this has been, it's been hard to not work, honestly. And I actually picked up a part-time teaching job at Emory University as an adjunct faculty because I was having a hard time not
help yourself.
Yeah, help myself. Yep. And that's been so incredibly rewarding working with bachelor's students, getting their degree in business. So that's been great. But it really, I mean, the sabbatical was really about just deciding to really focus on and giving critical mass of my time to this research, and it's phenomenal.
Fantastic. And what really fascinated me about our conversation earlier is that not only are you researching this topic, but you're also currently going through the process of finding your next CHRO role yourself. So can you share more about your experience? She was very honest and open with me earlier about what you're experiencing and then kind of gave you a newfound perspective from going through the process yourself.
It really did. Like, I started my career in HR as a recruiter, right? So talent acquisition is really near and dear to my heart, talent acquisition processes. I've worked, as a client of some of the best RPOs in the business, in working with, you know, some of the companies that I've worked with, and I know really great recruitment process, and I know, you know, not so great recruitment process. I've unfortunately, you know, led some teams where I always, you know, are pushing us to be better and better all the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being now on the other side of that, being the candidate, working with some amazing executive search firms, and some really great recruiters, it's a tough time in our profession right now for just how we balance this awesomeness of technology that allows for us to post a job and get hundreds, if not thousands, of applicants for a job. And then the challenge that comes with then creating a great candidate experience. And I have to say, it's, you know, sitting on the other side of it, I mean, I'm embarrassed to admit that I've had, you know, recruitment colleagues who've left, you know, who've stood me up on, you know, video interviews. I've been logged in for a video interview and they just don't show up. And I've unfortunately and embarrassingly been the recipient of going at being a final candidate for CHRO jobs and never hearing back.
That's crazy.
From the recruiter on what happened with that position. And so, I mean, final candidate, like met with the CEO of a company looking to hire a CHRO, and, you know, weeks go by and literally not getting an update call on what's happened with that job. And so, you know, look, these are great people. These are, you know, well-trained, well-intended, super networked executive recruiters. I know that there are good reasons why these things are happening. I know there had to have been a good reason why I got stood up on that video interview by that recruiter. I know there has to be a good reason why I didn't hear back from that recruiter related to that position. Yet, here I am, a candidate. This is my experience. It really doesn't feel good. And it really does drive me to, even more really think about what does this career transition experience look like, feel like, and how are we treating candidates? And I'll tell you, this will change how I coach and lead talent acquisition functions that report to me in the future. Probably fair warning, for anywhere that I land, I'll probably be taking a deep dive into our candidate experience process really early in my tenure.
And with the executive search firms that you use.
And with the executive search firms we use. That's right.
Yeah. Because you, how much control do you have? Or first and foremost, can everyone listening in the chat, can you relate to what Jen's saying? Because I can, because I've been in those situations where I've just not heard anything back. I've gone through four stages of interviews and got to the last stage and then nothing. And it makes you feel really insecure at some point. Yeah. I did. I was like, was it me? Did I say something wrong? You know,
sure.
You know, no feedback. I'd rather have some feedback, even if it's negative feedback, because at least it's constructive and I can, you know, go from there.
Right.
But not
That's
to hear
right.
anything at all. Especially at your level. I appreciate regardless of the job, it should be good. But I am actually shocked to hear at the executive level when you're interviewing at billion-dollar organizations.
That's right.
They still are not, haven't got this, you know, the candidate experience down. So pretty shocking. We're not going to mention any names, guys, but you know who you are.
That's right.
You know who you are, guys, who didn't come back to Jen, and shame on you. So why are they not coming back to you? Why are recruiters not coming back to the candidate? Is it because they're so busy? Is it because, you know, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I can only go by my own experience as a recruiter, right? And it's you know, been in very recent years that I was responsible for filling, you know, executive level jobs, at, you know, as an HR professional. And, you know, you do get just hundreds, if not thousands, of applicants for these jobs. And you know, it's such a challenge to, you know, ensure that the best candidates are rising to the top. And yes, I think, you know, I think recruiters are carrying very, very heavy requisition loads. I think that we look at, you know, the technological advances and we say, look, this can give us amazing efficiency, right? So because we have all these technological advances, we think recruiters can carry much heavier requisition loads than they have in the past. And so we're giving recruiters these very heavy requisition loads. And then, you know, it becomes very challenging for them to keep up with all of the details of that. And so, you know, like I'm going by, you know, my own experience of times when I have to look at myself and say, you know, in what searches did I potentially drop the ball as a recruiter, right? As I sit in judgment of having had these experiences, you know, did I call in late for an appointment with somebody because, you know, my schedule got so crazy and it was hard to manage that, you know, I connected, you know, 5-10 minutes late to an interview with somebody. And did that make them feel, you know, a lack of respect for them and for their time? I mean, I'm going to say, yeah, I probably, you know, that probably did happen with me as the recruiter in those situations.
Yeah.
You know, are there times when maybe I didn't get back to people and give them really valuable feedback that they needed to continue to, you know, continue on their search? Maybe they weren't the right fit for that job at that time, but, you know, they were really hungry for the feedback, like you were saying, right? So that at least they would know, okay, what was the reason? Is there something, am I okay with that reason? And I just say, look, this wasn't the right fit. And that thing that you're giving me feedback on, look, that's just who I am. And I'm okay with that. I'm okay that that wasn't a good fit. And I accept that we're not a match. Or was it feedback that they really needed to hear because they say, wow, that's not how I want to come across.
Mm.
And so I do want to change maybe how I answered that question or how I responded in that situation, because I really didn't represent myself well. And so I want to change that. And I think, you know, I think as a recruiter, I've not always given people that meaningful feedback that would help them. And again, you know, in this back and forth now of being on the other side, right? I think it changes how I see my responsibility to candidates.
Yeah.
In giving them that meaningful feedback so that they can then decide for themselves. Did I present myself in the best light and I wasn't a fit and that's okay? Or do I really want to tweak the way I'm presenting myself?
Yeah. And that's if you even get to that stage.
Right.
Yeah, we were talking about before, right, earlier, about how difficult now is to even get in the door for an interview, let alone get feedback and get to the second or third stage, the black hole of technology. And I was sharing an example with you, wasn't I, about, I'm not going to mention names here on LinkedIn Live, but I was working with one of our members, the chief HR officer, sort of one of the largest companies in the world, tech companies in the world, and was applying for a similar role who he was perfect for. Couldn't be better. And it dropped me an email saying, Chris, I'm trying to get hold of the HR leaders at this company because I want to you know, go for this new role. I can't get anyone. And I was like in shock. I was like, you are, you know, the HR executive, one of the biggest companies in the world, and you can't even get an interview and get through the door. And it's only through me making those personal introductions via email and phone call that I got an email a few weeks later saying, Chris, thank you so much. I'm now working in my dream job. Thank you. But the fact that person was just, you know, applying on LinkedIn, getting no response, going through executive search firms and still getting no response, and had to take it on themselves to, you know, reach out to their network, people like myself, and also pick up the phone and make it happen. Because leaving it into someone else's hands and sort of praying for your dream job is not the best strategy in the world. But I appreciate it's not easy for everyone to go ahead and do that. And they may not have the necessary network or skills to feel comfortable in picking up the phone and selling themselves for that role.
I feel like I was saying to Chris earlier today, you know, as a researcher right now, I often say when you're a hammer, everything's a nail, right? So everything looks like a future research project to me at the moment. And so, you know, to that point, right, I feel like we could write a paper, you know, when the funnel becomes a black hole.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you know, I feel like, you know, that's really what we're dealing with in talent acquisition right now, is that, you know, we have such an opportunity to attract such a wide variety of candidates. And then, you know, what do we do with that funnel, and how do we ensure that that funnel doesn't become a black hole? And, you know, I can say, you know, I've had people reach out to me and say, look, hey, you know, I see this job you know, in this company that I know that you work in, or that I know that you have a network into, you know, how.
This episode of the HR Leaders Podcast was brought to you by our friends at Achievers. 2/3 of employees have 1 foot out the door in 2024. And the top reason to job hunt? Better compensation. But money isn't everything. The Achievers 2024 Engagement and Retention Report reveals that employees crave emotional salary too. What does emotional salary mean? And what are the ways to increase emotional salary to engage and retain top talent? Learn more about motivating your employees beyond just pay by visiting achievers.com/HR leaders. Again, that's achievers.com/HR leaders. Let's get back to the episode.
How do I get noticed for this job? Because I feel like I'm the perfect candidate. And I say, you know, first of all, it's really important that you go ahead and apply online, because the company is going to want to make sure that your application is officially in that applicant tracking system. And that's just, you know, that's a sounds like a checkbox kind of thing, but you know, you definitely do want to go ahead and apply online. But then you do need to activate your personal network, right? So you do need to make those phone calls, make those linked out reach outs to people that you know and that know you, mm-hmm. and really follow that thread, because ultimately you are likely going to need somebody inside that organization to pull your application out of the black hole and put it toward the top of the stack. So the recruiter or the hiring manager actually reads your resume or actually look at your LinkedIn profile. Because, you know, it's of no intent. They're not intentionally ignoring.
Yeah, of course. If it doesn't have the right keywords,
the right candidate too.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just unfortunate because they have such a hard job where you guys are getting thousands of applications. And obviously a lot of that goes through the software, whether it's keyword, looking for different keywords and
that's right.
Within that. And there's so much incredible talent just being, you know, sent to the black hole and you never seen him ever again. So it's tough on both sides. So definitely not one-sided. And some of the, for everyone listening, if you're looking to apply for a job on LinkedIn, or and one of the pieces of advice I'll give you, which has worked for me and a lot of friends in my circle, is when you go on LinkedIn, right, you see a job that's been posted. You can see the person on LinkedIn who's posted that job. On the right-hand side, you can see the name. What I always do with a friend is click on the person who's posted that job on LinkedIn and message them personally on LinkedIn, say hi, and you know, write a little statement about why you feel you're right for that role, and reach out to them directly to set up a call or a time to talk, as opposed to just applying on LinkedIn and that's hoping right. they come back to you. And I had a friend recently who spent the entire weekend, sent a few hundred messages. It sounds like a lot of work. And 3 days later, he had a job at a company he really wanted to work for. But, you know, take it into your own hands as opposed to just applying to jobs and in the hope someone replies as well. And if you guys are interested, I have a template that I made for my friends who are looking for new roles that they send to people on LinkedIn and hiring managers about why they feel like, and so if you can fill in the gaps in the middle yeah. about why you feel, just sit there, spend a day messaging, you know, do your LinkedIn sales navigator search, find those jobs that you're interested in, and message the hiring managers directly. They're going to hate me for saying that by now, but it works, right? So, yeah. So that's from my own sales experience as well. So, Hasrat mentioned in the chat. He said, "Why did you decide to leave the organization to go on a sabbatical as opposed to going on a sabbatical? You know, doing what you're doing now and then returning to the same organization, just out of interest."
Yeah. So, I mean, I hate to sound like a real HR person here, but I am. Look, it depends, right? I mean, every situation is very individual. If your company allows for educational sabbaticals and you can take a sabbatical and return to the same company, I think that's fantastic. I think, you know, if those options are available and that's, and you are really enjoying the relationship that you have with your company, and that's something that can be worked out. I think, you know, look, as an HR professional, I'm always going to be up for, you know, the retention of talent and the development of talent inside an organization. So to the degree that you can work that out with your company and do that, you know, inside and work out that relationship, I think that's an amazing opportunity. My choice was a very individual one, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it just made sense for me to do it the way I did. but that doesn't mean that I would, you know, I had an emotional reaction, Chris, when you were reading that question and it said, you know, should I resign my job and go for higher education? My, you know, kind of my emotional reaction to that was, I, you know, like, oh my gosh, that's not necessarily what I'm recommending to anybody at all, except that, I don't know, maybe I am, right?
Yeah, maybe it's right for you at that right time. It really depends.
Like exactly. Right. I mean,
don't quit your job if you've got a mortgage, guys.
Right.
And you've got a family to feed. Don't go and quit your job and go on educational sabbatical, unless you can afford it, right?
Right. I mean, that's a big decision to make, right? So if you know, this is not a financial planning podcast or a, you know, financial planning LinkedIn Live, right? But you know, I would say, you know, don't resign your job if you don't have a financial plan for how you're going to make that work for yourself.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, and it's great that you've taken the time out to focus on your own personal development. The entire reason that we started this company is to give senior HR executives that time away from the organization to network, benchmark, and learn from their peers in that environment, because during the day at work, they're so caught up in the day and day running of the organization. They're so, you get opportunity to reflect and see where you are. And on that point, I'm really excited that you're going to be joining us in New York at Johnson & Johnson for our next workshop. So it's kind of testament that you've also invested in us as an organization, again, for your personal development. So I really appreciate that. John had a really good question. He asked that, you know, within the organizations that you worked within, you've led, you know, HR functions in huge multinational, so billion-dollar organizations, right? Yeah. With your team, how did you mitigate bias in the recruitment process? Did you have a mandatory training for everyone in your team?
Yeah. So, you know, in the companies that I've worked for, we do unconscious bias training. Yeah. You know, that's certainly been the most successful recently is really helping people understand their own unconscious bias and having a framework and a plan for how you can recognize when you might be leaning into your own bias so that you can question that and make sure that you are making really great decisions. But definitely believe in mandatory, compulsory. I would hope that most recruitment professionals, most HR professionals, you don't have to make it mandatory for them to get excited to be a part of it, right?
Yeah, like, it kind of takes away a bit of the excitement about if you say it's mandatory.
Yeah. And so, you know, look, in truth, it was mandatory.
Of course.
Right. But I didn't necessarily, you know, we didn't as a team necessarily market it that way. It was more like, hey, we have this really great training that's gonna make you think about your job as a recruiter a little bit differently. And so, you know, and that was, you know, most recently unconscious bias training. It, you know, throughout my career, it's been, you know, as the work in diversity and inclusion and belonging has changed over time, right? Thankfully, the training and how we think about it and how we educate ourselves to be aware has changed over time. And so in the beginning, it was really just some awareness training or what we called it 20 years ago, you know, sensitivity training, right? Being more aware of how you see the world and that other people see the world differently than you do. And just had some really amazing experiences over the years with those kinds of training. But yes, I think hiring managers should have to, in a perfect world, any organization would have their hiring managers go through unconscious bias training and understand that, look, we are naturally attracted to people who make us feel good about ourselves. And the people who make us feel good about ourselves are the people who validate us. And so when we are giving ourselves and we feel like ourselves are coming back, that's a validation to our identity and to ourselves. And this gets a little bit into my research, honestly, on identity and career transition, is that there's this validation process of like, okay, who I am is resonating with you, and who you are is resonating with me, and we're validating each other's identities. And then both people walk away going, wow, I really liked that person. Well, what is it I liked? Well, I liked that he or she made me feel good about myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's then how we end up building teams where maybe there isn't the kind of diversity that we actually state we want, right? Yeah. We want diversity. We know the business case for diversity. We know it should be there. Nobody's arguing that. But then how do you actually make it happen? And actually making it happen is that recruiters and hiring managers have to be aware of their own bias, aware of the fact that they get attracted to people who validate them and make them feel good about themselves, mm-hmm. and make sure that we're really selecting people that are going to challenge us and that are going to make us better as a team.
Yeah, completely agree with you. And I had one more question from Kripa before we jump into your sort of research into what you're doing now. And she asked from a personal point of view, during this transition and this period of reflection and learning yourself, do you look at HR differently now? Are there anything that, you know, what's come to mind for yourself? Anything you do differently now looking back when you move into your next role? What will you be doing differently?
I hesitate to say that this is an example of how I look at it differently, but maybe how I look at it in more fullness.
Sure. Understand.
Right.
Yeah.
So, understand. You know, I feel it in. And so what I would say is that, you know, in thinking about it, I really have. And Chris, this was something that came up with us this morning. I really have been thinking a lot about how adding technology to HR processes is affecting our relationship with employees inside of organizations. And so if human resources is really the, you know, kind of the owner of the employee to organization relationship, and how do we cause people to feel really connected and really feel like they are part of something bigger than themselves, and not just a number, right? They're not just their employee ID in the HRIS system, right? But that they are really a valued member of this team. And when you work in an organization that has 60,000 employees, that's not always easy to do, right? But, you know, so in really thinking about that, what I have been spending a lot of time thinking about and what I think I would do in more fullness moving forward, it's just really asking those questions around, okay, look, employee self-service is good. Manager self-service is good. But what connection point do we lose with that? And how do we both embrace what is good about technology, about efficiency, about employee and manager self-service without losing those meaningful connection points? And I use a really simple example to kind of illustrate it. And I say, okay, look, you know, let go back, you know, 20 years ago and you were a part of an organization and you were buying your first house, right? You're a young family, you have school age kids, you were going from renting a property that somebody else owned to you're now moving and buying your own home in a school district you've chosen because this is what's good for you and your family. You would potentially walk into the office of your HR representative and you would say, hey, we moved. I have a new address. And there would be interaction. There would be humanness. There would be, tell me about
bonding.
You bought a new house and are you excited? And this would have been a celebratory moment for you. Now, and you would have shared that with another human being that you work with that makes you feel connected to and tied to. Now, you, if you ask HR how you change your address, you get an email back with a link.
Not even an email, a chatbot.
Right, that's right, a chatbot. Exactly.
You get a chatbot reply saying, enter here, update here.
Correct, right? That gives you a link where you can go do it yourself. Now, the reality is that it's not that you mind typing in your own address on this link. That's the way the world has turned and we're all used to it and it's fine. So look, keep the link, keep the employee self-service. That's important. But how do we ensure that we don't lose the human aspect that was a part of that potential celebration? Even if it was just 2 or 3 minutes of, we're so excited we bought our first house, right? Yeah. But does that get lost? Does that human connection get lost? And I'm not saying that's the only way it happens. That's just an example of how all of this has changed the way I'm thinking about, you know, I love technology. technology. I love applying technology. I'm always going to look for ways to make something more efficient, better. And I'll continue to do that as an HR leader, but I'm not going to forget to ask myself and my team the question, is there a lost opportunity to connect and what are we going to do about it?
Yeah. I think that's the balance, isn't it, between the human element and the technology that we have to find.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us more about the research you're doing at the moment.
Yeah. So I'm really excited about it. So I have just a real passion around supporting our military in their career transition. So after they've served, whether that be for 4 years or whether that be for 30 years, oftentimes there's a choice to leave the military and then go into a civilian career. And especially those folks who serve, 4, 6, 10 years, they're in their, late 20s, early 30s, looking for, the fullness of a civilian career from that point forward. And so really thinking about this career transition process and what that means to them. And I started really thinking about belonging. And it's so important. In almost everything that we've talked about here, just now, there's been some tie back to, feeling like you belong. And that's so critically important. And so as I dug into that idea of belonging and what that must mean what that must look like for an Army veteran who's moving from their service in the Army into the civilian career world, it really became more of an individual question of identity and how we manage our identity, right? So if somebody has identified as being a soldier in the Army, that's been incredibly important to them and to their family and to their way of life during their time of service. And now they're making the decision to discharge and to go into the civilian workforce. And what part of that identity will always be a part of who they are? And how do we help them move that identity into the civilian work world? And so, thinking about that outplacement process that they go through, which the Army calls Soldier for Life Transition Assistance Program, learning how to write resumes so that the civilian world can understand them, learning how to interview so that you're really able to communicate your transferable skills. And then you get that job offer and now you go to onboarding, right? And now it's this opportunity to learn, what does it mean to be a part of this new organization? And how am I expected to behave here? And how do I belong here? And what happens to my identity as a soldier or my identity as a veteran, right? Because I go from maybe potentially seeing my identity as an active duty soldier to now seeing my identity as an Army veteran. But how does all of that, what does all of that look like in terms of now I'm trying to be a member of this new community, mm-hmm. this civilian workforce, this company that I'm joining? And what does that look like? And look, as humans, we all manage many roles and many identities, right? So we are sons and daughters and sisters and workers and friends and parents. Right. And so we're not any one identity at a time. We are always a bit of a, I've heard it described as a kaleidoscope of identities. And I really like that. I really like that visual. But then there's a management piece that comes to that. So that's really what I'm digging into. I'll be speaking with Army veterans and talking to them about their experience of moving into the civilian world and really trying to understand how that experience affected their identity. Mm-hmm. And by learning from people who went through it and learning from how their identity was affected, I hope to then come back to the world of HR practice and say, look, here's what I've learned from people who have gone through it. Here's how the programs and processes that we put in place as HR teams either work or don't work. And so what can we do to encourage them to embrace the identities that give them confidence and self-efficacy while also making sure that they feel like they really do belong with us and they're a good fit with us, because we want to hire them and we want to retain them.
Yeah. And you mentioned beforehand that during the time, for example, at Burger King, when you was looking to hire 20%, I think you had sort of three or 400 roles to fill at the time.
That's right.
And you wanted sort of 20% of that to come from sort of the ex-military coming in. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you also mentioned in terms of them writing their own CVs, they were encouraged not to share too much information. Can you explain a bit more about that, which I thought was a real shame considering the leadership skills they developed and the incredible skills that you developed within the army that are transferable into the corporate world?
Yeah. So I'll say that this was, you know, this was occurring more than 10 years ago, and we've come a very long way. There are some amazing services and databases and organizations out there that have really helped with this problem over the last decade. And so we're doing much better today. But yes, it was a very real example where, you know, I was hiring, and it was 200 people across the country. It was a new role that we were putting in place in our franchise services division of Burger King. And we had the opportunity. I could set those hiring goals, and I had the support that I needed to say, look, I want 20% of this group of new hires to be military veterans, because at that point we were roughly 10 years past 9/11. There had been a lot of volunteer troops that had gone to Iraq and Afghanistan. They were coming home and they were looking for this transition. And the Obama administration had Hiring Our Heroes as a part of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And there was a lot going on. And it was in the news a lot, right? Hire a veteran, hire a veteran. I was like, look, we can do this at Burger King. We are really committed to doing this. And we had the will to do it. And we had a really hard time finding veterans. And some of it had to do with, I believe, technology and keyword searching and those kinds of things. And you bring up, you know, there was so much going on at that time around, you know, write your resume so that you're using civilian terminology.
Yeah, which is a shame.
And there just was, there's, you know, lost in translation.
Yeah.
Right. And that's some research that I did last summer is that whole idea of like, how do you translate the military experience into the civilian world? To your point, there's the leadership skills. They get so much leadership training. There's, you know, the idea of resilience and self-efficacy. I mean, there's just so much like really positive, you know, sometimes we call it soft skills, right? And a veteran probably doesn't like to hear that they are desired for their soft skills. but that's true, right?
Yeah, I mean, of course.
That's a reality, right? They do learn a lot of amazing leadership skills.
Yep.
And think about some of these non-commissioned officers. It's a very particular area of passion for me is this idea that, you know, non-commissioned officers are managing million-dollar budgets. They're managing hundreds of troops. But yet oftentimes they haven't yet had the time to get maybe a bachelor's degree because they've been very busy with their military service and they have very full lives as non-commissioned officers and oftentimes with young families. And so they come out of the military and they're even though they likely have more transferable experience in managing large budgets and managing large teams.
In chaos, right? Which is what we need in corporations right now, leading through the VUCA world.
Yes, yeah. Right. Likely more relatable and transferable experiences than their MBA cohorts coming out of some very well-known schools with amazing programs. I cast no shadow. I have a master's degree. I'm getting a doctorate. Clearly, I believe in higher education. But that said, how do you match up? So you've got somebody coming out with an MBA. I'm sure they're brilliant, but have they managed these very large multi-million dollar budgets? Have they managed these very large hundreds of troops sized teams in comparison? And sometimes we overlook these NCOs and these amazing experiences that they have. And, you know, we lean toward this, high-priced brand name MBA. And again, casting no shade, I'm just saying it's something to think about a bit differently.
Yeah, definitely. One of the questions I had from John on LinkedIn said, how do you approach the veteran community that represent different dimensions of diversity and have different experiences? So the LGBT community, for example, do you have any experience in that area? Have you done any research around that of how you would approach the different diverse communities?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, one thing is that, you know, certainly the military community is as diverse, and it has been said that in some ways, maybe even more diverse than the population at large, right? And so by, you know, to use, you know, my old school recruiting terms, if I'm fishing in that pond, right, that's a very highly diverse pond to fish in. And so that's just a good thing in and of itself. You're likely to have a very diverse workforce coming out of the military. I have not done any specific research on the military and the LGBTQ community. That's not an area that I consider myself an expert at all. Mm-hmm. I think that is, I think people who have a passion in that in particular, I would encourage research there because I think it's really important. Mm-hmm. I think it's still a very, very tough topic, right? I think there's still a lot of emotion around how how we manage and make sure that we are honoring the LGBTQ community in who desire to serve in the military and desire, and that gets me to that identity management, right? In terms of how do I, fulfill a desire I have to serve my country and be a member of the military and still stay true to myself and who I am and not feel like I have to mask or hide who I am. Yeah. And, that's still a very challenging topic. I don't think that we have great answers on that yet.
Yeah, definitely agree to that. For everyone listening as well, guys, let us know, what were your biggest challenges that you faced during your career transitions? We wanted to go live today to hear from you, to hear your experiences and insights as well. Whilst we're waiting for those questions to come in, I'd love you to share your story about how you use technology in your recruitment process and you use video. That is part of the challenge is obviously engaging with candidates. And I think video is definitely an area where we're seeing great strides. And you mentioned how it was so useful for you and the team. So you can you share more on that?
Absolutely. Yeah, happy to. This was a couple of years ago, but I know that it's still video interviewing has only gained traction. But I was an early adopter. I worked specifically with WePOW at the time when I was at New Signature. As the CHRO and responsible for IT recruiting. And at New Signature, we were very, very passionate about hiring folks who were very highly qualified from an IT skills perspective and also had just an amazing customer service approach and attitude. It was really what we were built on and how important it was to us. And so there were a lot of very interested stakeholders. And so I was sharing with Chris that our interview panels became very large.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people who wanted to be a part of the decision-making process on the hires that we were bringing into the organization. And that is both a blessing and a curse when you're the recruiter, right? Like you want that level of engagement from the decision makers. You don't want to be on an island. You certainly as a recruiter don't want to feel like you're the only one meeting this candidate and making this decision. And you really want that consensus and that collaboration. But then also, we all know that with every additional interviewer adds time to schedule, time to do, time to get together, all of that, right? So video interviewing was a godsend, right? So it was recorded video. So the way, and you can obviously do live video very much like what we're doing right now. And that is very common, and I think used a lot. I think live video is used a lot in interviews today, mm-hmm. but I don't know if recorded video is used as often, but I find it incredibly helpful, especially when you have a lot of decision makers.
Explain your process of how you did, because I think a lot of people would be quite new to them, and it was great because it helped you take out some of the complexity
that's right.
from your leaders, and then also gave them some urgency as leaders to not get distracted and also make sure they're engaged in the process.
And it, and I will share the process. And I'll say the other thing that it definitely did was it allowed the candidates to actually meet, if you will, some of the highest level leaders in the organization. So I recorded some of the cultural fit type questions as the CHRO of the company.
What were some of those questions? I'm sure people were thinking, what are those? What questions would the HR executive CHRO want to know to see if I'm a cultural fit? What were they?
Sure. So as I was mentioning, high touch customer service was critically important to us, right? So as an IT consultant, whether it was in a help desk job or whether it was an engineer solving, some pretty important, data center kinds of data mapping issues, right? That customer service and that ability to gather information from the customer and be high touch. So my questions were very much around, pretty standard, behavioral interviewing questions around, tell me about a time when you had a difficult customer situation and how did you win that person over, right? Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that the questions themselves were magic, right? It was, your pretty standard questions, but I recorded myself asking those questions.
Which is important,
would record their answers. And then additionally, we had the chief technology officer ask and record himself asking very specific technology driven questions, things that were really important to him. And I won't be able to tell you what any of those questions were. Yeah. 5 years ago, I knew them, but right now I don't.
Of course, of course.
Yes, but they were very, very specific, engineering type questions. And so then we would get these recorded videos back. They would be 10 to 15 minutes worth of video interview. And every candidate had answered the same questions, right? So we were getting to that, what you always try to do as a recruiter, right? With structured interviews to try to have that apples to apples comparison. Mm-hmm. And because it was recorded, both the questions were recorded and the answers were recorded, we in fact had the same pieces of data on every candidate. And so then I would send that link out to the interview committee, and that might have been as many as 10 people might have been on this interview committee. They all watched the video. When I would send it out, with a meeting invite, and I would basically give them 5 business days and say, look, I'm sending this out on Wednesday afternoon. Next Wednesday afternoon, we're going to have a call. Everybody who can make it is going to come, and we're going to talk about your experience of having watched these videos and decide if this candidate moves on to live round.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't, you miss out.
That's right.
Yeah, it's your own fault.
And so, I would say to them, look, I know we do this a lot. I know it's very time consuming, but here's the deal. If you feel really strongly one way or the other, you need to absolutely show up to this discussion.
Yeah, love it.
If you don't feel strongly one way or the other about this candidate, you're okay that we hire them or you're okay that we don't, and something else pops onto your calendar, just know that the people who do show up are going to make the decision.
Yeah. Fantastic. I'm so happy you shared that story, because I think more and more now we need to start using similar tools. That's where I see technology is really interesting. Absolutely. You get to see the personality behind both the lead. You get to feel connected to both the people that are interviewing you and the candidate.
Yes.
Through video. And that's what the magic of video is. And which is why we're all here with you guys right now, is that, some people that I consider my best friends, I've never met them for years, and I spoke to them through Zoom calls and video. Yeah. A lot of CHROs that I work with that are members, they've known me for 3-4 years, and we meet face to face, and they're like, I feel like I already know them and they know me. So I want to go back to the career.
Oh, I was going to say, that's why when you started out, a little while ago, and you let everyone know that we really did only just meet a couple of hours ago. That is true, but I feel like I know you because I've been watching and listening to your podcast for the last couple of years. So I was like, wow, that's actually true. I really didn't know Chris until this morning.
Exactly. But we hit off straight away, I'm happy we're here now. I just want to go back to the career transitions piece, because Sophie Smallwood in the chat brought up a really great point, and we did discuss this in that earlier about the career transitions going from maternity leave back to work.
Yes.
And by the way, Sophie, I've recently become a dad myself personally, and my wife, we're just starting that conversation right now. And there is already some anxiety on my wife's side, and she won't mind me saying that as well, about, you know, what that means for her to go back now as a mum. As you know, it's very different. So can you touch on that as well? Because I know you've also looked into that.
Yeah, well, and so I'll say, I do often talk about it as it is not a part of my research at this point, but I do believe that my study could be replicated.
Yes.
Looking at that group as well, or that transition, I should say, as well, right? So my research is very much focused on, Army to civilian transition. But I believe that after the fact, I could very easily replicate it, looking at that stay-at-home mom population who then chooses to go back to work. And what does that mean in terms of that career transition? And what does that mean in terms of that identity management, right? Chris and I were talking this morning, right? We kind of accept that once a mom, always a mom, right? Like Chris and I were joking about the fact that, we are adults well into our career, and our moms still call us to check on us if they get a sense of, like, I'm not sure Jen's okay, I should call her. Yeah. Right. And that still happens. And so, once a mom, always a mom. But that's an identity that we don't expect anybody to let go of. But then what does that look like, and how does one manage that when, let's say, they, become the chief marketing officer of their organization, and now they have these, what feels like competing identities of being a mom, being a chief marketing officer, and how do we help them in the organization manage that? And I think, that is critical to that whole conversation of belonging, that whole conversation about, we know that, we have a loneliness epidemic, right, in this country. And you can, and we've heard it said for many decades that it's lonely at the top, right? Yeah. So, you talk to executives, and sometimes they feel the most isolated. And yet they're the ones trying to, potentially manage some of the most complex identities of, their identities in their family units and their identities at work. And so, yeah, it's definitely, I appreciate Sophie bringing up the point. And I think that it's a really critical conversation we need to continue to have.
Yeah. Even just a few days ago, I was speaking to one of our members, the CHRO of a large pharmaceutical company. And I gave her a call. She recently became a mum, and she went back after a very short period, I think only sort of 3 or 4 months. And she was like, Chris, I'm struggling because, it's quite strange. I mean, she's the only female on the leadership team, first and foremost, and she just had a baby. So she felt a lot of pressure to actually go back to work, which also wasn't great. And that was already a concern. And then secondly, the fact that she's like, Chris, they don't understand when I'm like, I have to leave this boardroom right now because I need to go and express milk.
Right.
and my wife's going through that now. Even like, how do you say, oh, sorry, guys, let me just interrupt our global strategy meeting. I need to go out and pump milk and express, so that self sense of belonging is she's come, people are looking at her differently, treating her differently. There was even an instance where there was a global sort of strategy meeting that she didn't get invited to. And then they said, why didn't you, or we didn't invite you because we thought you wouldn't want to travel.
Right.
So, unconscious bias, they meant it in their, they thought they were doing a good thing. Whereas in reality, now she feels excluded. So the entire leadership team is going to be at that meeting and she's not there as well. So these are real concerns.
I would say, one of the most important things that I learned along the way, just as it relates to diversity and belonging and making sure that we are including people and not unintentionally excluding people, is just a really simple, don't make assumptions.
Yes.
I remember early in my career.
We all do it as well, right? I'm guilty of it. Everyone's guilty of it.
Yes, yeah. It's natural. Yep. We have to make a decision not to make assumptions, because left to our own devices, it's an economy of our brain power.
Yeah.
Right? Like we can't, there are just some things that you just go on rote and you just go on assumption, because it would be exhausting if you stopped and gave 15 minutes thought to absolutely everything you do, right? Mm-hmm. But when it comes to making decisions, you know, for your coworkers or about your peers, I would say, you know, use an abundance of caution in making assumptions, right? I feel like, you know, I had a situation early in my career where I had a boss assume that because I, you know, made some comments about loving the new house that I had bought and the town that I was living in, she made an assumption that I wouldn't be willing to relocate. And so she didn't bring a career opportunity to my attention because it would have required relocation. Well, I never said I wouldn't relocate. I did love the house that I just bought. I did love the community that I was living in, but not to the extent that I wouldn't have considered a career opportunity.
Yeah, that also happens a lot.
That I was like, wow, what a lesson. Don't ever make that assumption. Give people the option and then be okay with what they decide.
Yeah. But sometimes it also works about negatively on the other side is then you stop sharing how you feel.
Or, that's right.
Or stop sharing that you've just become a mom or that something important has happened because you think, well, what are they going to think?
That's
you
right.
Know, for me, a big part of mine was I suffer from anxiety and have done for my whole life. And only in the last 2 years have I actually started talking about it because, mm-hmm. you know, there would be weeks where I wouldn't even turn up into the office and because I couldn't leave my house because I felt like I was having a heart attack every time I wanted to leave the door. And I didn't understand what was going on. And I was embarrassed to tell my CEO and my sales director because I thought they're not going to give me that promotion because they're going to think that, you know, I'm mentally unstable. I was embarrassed to tell my peers, my friends, even my wife that I was going through that. And I would make excuses of why I wouldn't go to on holiday or to this party or this friend's house because I was feeling really anxious and I didn't understand what it was. And again, I didn't want to tell anyone because I was worried about what they would think as well. So yeah, it's very interesting. Well, before we wrap up, I think we can stay on there for another hour if we wanted to, but this wasn't even planned, everyone listening. And thank you so much for all your questions. We really appreciate it. And we did this because we wanted to bring you guys on the journey with us. So it's been fantastic. Before we wrap up, Jen, we're going to jump into our quick fire round. You listen to the show, so you know what is, what's coming, right? All right. So I'm going to ask you 5 questions. You've got 30 seconds, to give us some amazing answers. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
What was the number one thing that was holding you back from becoming a successful HR executive?
Self-editing. So sometimes not being willing to bring up ideas because I would dismiss them as not yet complete. Not yet, you know, I like to brainstorm. I like to work with others to bring, you know, things to fruition. And so sometimes I wouldn't speak up and offer ideas because I knew that it was a bit half-baked. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I had to bring a finished product, but then I'd get caught up in not having a finished product because I need others to co-create with. So it put me in a bit of a spin. I wasn't speaking up, but I also wasn't able to complete because I wasn't speaking up.
I know exactly how you feel. And I'm sure everyone listening right now can resonate to what you're saying. What's the best piece of business advice you've ever received?
It sounds crazy, but have a budget.
For yourself personally?
I'm
joking.
Whether that's when I was starting my coffee house that I co-owned with a partner for 7 years, right? Or whether it's running an HR department and you know, wanting to try something new, like, you know, it sounds crazy, it's something we take for granted, right?
Yeah.
Something we take for granted, but I would say it really was the best piece of advice around, you know, resources are not unlimited. Know what you're willing to spend on it and set your budget.
What books would you recommend, or a book? It doesn't have to be HR related. Would you recommend to our listeners any around a particular topic we've spoken about today that come to mind, or if not any HR books or books that come to mind?
Yeah, well, I mean, some of the ones that I literally order all the time and hand out to my team. But I'm a huge fan of Cy Wakeman's Reality Based Leadership.
Yep.
I am a huge fan of Mark Efron's One Page Talent Management and everything that Dave Ulrich writes.
I'll let him know.
Yeah, big Dave Ulrich fangirl here. So I have all of his books. He's signed a couple of them for me. But yeah, so that's, I mean, those are definitely, reality-based leadership really definitely changed the way I led teams. And so that's why I literally, I hand that one out all the time.
And similar on that point, could you say some online resources that you use? You know, if we looked at your internet browser at work, you know, where are you spending your time to keep yourself up to date with current events and, you know, what's happening in this new world of work?
Yeah. So, current events, I mean, I love my Morning Brew newsletter that shows up in my email box every morning. Yeah. So it's a financial news newsletter, which is just great. I think they do an amazing job with it. I have to say Georgia State University's business library is probably in my history more than anything right now. Just doing a ton of research. Gosh, what else?
Well, I know we discussed LinkedIn earlier because that's how we. Oh. You can't. Absolutely. Can you plug LinkedIn whilst live streaming into LinkedIn? I don't know if that's. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yes. And I think LinkedIn does a fantastic job with some of their aggregation of news stories and things. And I definitely that's definitely high on my list.
Yeah, it's. I love. Obviously, that's how we connected, right? We wouldn't be here right now. LinkedIn message. Phone call, here we are, right?
That's and
not only are we here live on LinkedIn, but I'll be seeing you in a few months in New York, right? So
It's
incredible how you're just one connection away from anyone.
And
it's been sort of a game changer for me to be able to connect with all of you guys and to bring everyone listening great minds like yourself. So it's fantastic. Well, look, thank you so much for taking the time out to join us on the show. It's been incredible. It's been great to get to know you this morning and having you here this afternoon. And I'm sure everyone listening would agree. You definitely provide some great insights and advice for everyone. So thank you very much for that.
Before, thanks for having me. It was fun.
No problem. Before we wrap up, if there's sort of one parting piece of guidance you could give to other HR leaders that are on their journey or developing on that journey, what would that be? And then secondly, if anyone wants to get in contact with you, what's the best way for them to do so?
So I would say, you know, my parting piece of advice is just, you know, now in a time where, you know, technology is going to continue to change the way we work, don't forget the human and human resources, and don't forget to stay connected. And I think that's going to be our task as HR professionals. And then as far as getting a hold of me, probably the best way is LinkedIn. I do check my LinkedIn every day.
Shamefully, so, we all say that shamefully. We're like, oh,
yeah, I do. It's here on my phone, and I'm always looking at it. So yeah, please shoot me a note, shoot me an inbox, and on LinkedIn, and I will absolutely respond.
Fantastic. Well, for everyone listening, guys, once again, thank you for joining us. If you're not already following me here on LinkedIn, if you enjoyed the content, make sure you follow me here. And also follow Jen as well on LinkedIn. Jen, we need some more content from you.
Okay. Get it out there.
You get it out there. And if you guys are available at 3:30 p.m. on Friday, we'll be going live again with another workshop. So hopefully another podcast and workshop. So hopefully we'll see you all there.